The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
All right, good morning, everybody. I want to start by quoting a few leaders of our nation. Quote, "Education is the great civil rights issue of our time." George W. Bush, 2002. "The educational achievement gap is the civil rights issue of our time." Former U.S. Secretary of Education Rod Page, 2004. "Education is the civil rights movement of our generation." Arnie Duncan, 2010. "Education is the civil rights issue of our time." President Barack Obama, 2011. And not to be outdone, "Education is the civil rights issue of our time." U.S. President Donald Trump. That's how Wayne Al starts his chapter called "Racial Justice is Not a Choice in Teaching for Black Lives." And every presidency in the last couple decades has claimed that making educational equality is one of the primary goals of their administration, and yet we see inequality and institutional racism in our schools reproduced year after year with more ferocity every year, right? So what's going on with that? Well, we could start by looking at who they appoint to lead the schools in this great civil rights crusade that they're on. How about Betsy DeVos? The civil rights crusader. She came to Seattle recently where I teach. And we had not so warm a welcome for her. I penned an open letter to her right before she came to Seattle. I want to read part of it to you now. I said, "Dear Secretary DeVos, my name is Jesse Hagopian. I teach ethnic studies at Seattle's Garfield High School. I hope you didn't just stop reading this letter after you heard the subject I'm teaching. I urge you to keep reading. I'm writing in regards to the Washington Policy Center's $350 a person fundraising dinner you will be addressing on October 13th at the Hyatt Regency in the nearby city of Bellevue. There will be bullhorns, signs, speeches, and I bet some of the more creative teachers, perhaps a few of the art teachers your proposed budget cut haven't cut yet, will show up in grizzly bear costumes to reference the asinine comment you made defending the use of guns in school when you said they needed to be protected from potential grizzlies. There will be black people there and civil rights organizations there because you refused to say if the federal government would bar funding for private schools that discriminate. These anti-racist activists will also be there because of your outrageous attempt to promote charter schools and voucher schemes to privatize public education by claiming that historically black colleges and universities are, quote, pioneers of school choice, as if segregation and shutting out black people from higher education was a magnificent decision. To be fair, I want to acknowledge that the destruction you are causing in public education didn't begin with you. When your predecessor, Secretary of Education Arnie Duncan, came to town, well, we protested him too. Like you, he was also committed to privatizing education. He just didn't have your zeal for the voucher approach. And Duncan had an even bigger desire than you to reduce a student's intellectual and emotional learning to a single number on a test that he could then use to punish a child, a teacher, or a school. So I'm well aware that to truly transform our public education system, to make it about empowering students to be critical thinkers and change makers, it must go far beyond just removing you. To achieve the schools our children deserve, it will surely require a mass grassroots uprising of educators, students, parents, unions, working people, the poor, LGBTQ people, women, people of color, and human rights organizations who will ultimately be empowered to democratically run their own school systems. Thankfully, all these constituents will be at this rally, so hopefully we can start talking about our vision for remaking the schools without billionaires and corporate reformers who see dollar signs where they should see children. See you in a few days. Sincerely, Jesse Hagopian. She, thank you. She didn't respond, but we had a good time. And this bipartisan attack has continued year after year because the political class that's in control of our country and the school system has made it their agenda. And I want to refer to the work of Professor Nolly Rooks, who wrote a really important book called Cutting School. It's pretty new. If you haven't read it, I suggest everybody read this. And in the book, she coins a term called segronomics. And she talks about why it's really segronomics that's driving this agenda. She defines segronomics as, quote, the separate, segregated, and unequal forms of education that have provided the opportunity for business to make a profit selling schools. And then she goes on to explain this profit motive that has been introduced into the education system. She writes, in the fall of 2000, a financial industry publication, the Journal of Private Equity, published an article titled Investment Opportunities in Education, Making a Profit While Making a Difference. The article tracked the upsurge in Wall Street interests in education during the previous decade, saying that it was in the first 10 years of the 21st century that private investments had increased from $2.5 million in 1990 to $4 billion in 2000, right? And they wrote in the Business Insider, quote, although education is a huge part of the U.S. economy, until recently, it wasn't much of a business. But as the millennium dawns, the private sector is poised to play a much larger role, fueled by the explosion in the money available to education startups, right? And that drive towards privatization and sucking public funds into to private companies is driving much of this this segronomics agenda. And so what I want to talk to you all today is about how the segronomics agenda is leading to the capturing and caging of black and brown youth in this country. I want to talk about how I want to explain that school-to-prison pipeline first. Then I want to talk about the rise of a new movement that is sweeping this country, the Black Lives Matter at School movement, and talk about how it got started and what its goals are and how we can really grow it. And then I want to talk about how we can overthrow segronomics and build a different school system and a different society. Right on. So, okay. So let's look at the school-to-prison pipeline. You know, we starts with these hyper-segregated schools. Our school system is more segregated today than at any time since Brown versus Board of Education passed. And so we have hyper-segregation and concentrated poverty in these schools. But then we really have to look at what's being taught in the schools, right? We have to start with the curriculum. And there's been some incredible examples over the last couple years of what's being taught to our black youth. A couple years ago, there was the incredible example from Texas where a boy named Kobe Byrne was reading his world geography book, and he opened it up and found that it had replaced the word slave with the word worker, and talked about how workers were brought from Africa. And what was worse was that section of the book on slavery was actually put in the section on immigration, as if black people had hopped on boats looking for a better world, right? And so I'd been using that example in my classroom to talk about the master narrative, and part of me was a little worried that it was gonna get dated. That was like 3 years ago. But these corporate education textbook companies, not to disappoint, came up with another example last year In case you think the problem is just the South, the textbook from Connecticut called The Connecticut Adventure. Amazing. The Connecticut Adventure, this girl came home from school to do her homework, and the question asked her, how were the slaves treated in Connecticut? And she wrote, the slaves were treated badly and cruelly. And then she crossed it out, and she wrote, the slaves were treated like family. And her mom saw that and said, wait a second, what's going on? How did you just cross out that they were treated cruelly? And she said, Mom, it's right there in the book. And you look, and the book says that slaves were treated like family in Connecticut. And then most recently, there was a viral post about a teacher in Texas that had the two columns on the worksheet and asked students to list the positive and the negative aspects of slavery, right? And this was at a charter school in Texas, and it was outrageous, and that, you know, that teacher would miseducate people like that. But the thing that was truly astounding wasn't just one teacher that was outrageous, but the fact that worksheet was based on the textbook, right? That actually laid the basis for looking at what the positive aspects of slavery might be. Right? And too often, when kids disengage with the classroom and they act out, they're just labeled defiant. But maybe we need to understand that better as resistance to a racist curriculum. If they're not being engaged, right, we need to look at what's being taught in these schools and what should be taught. And then when they disengage and are pushed out of the classroom, we know that there's a zero tolerance discipline policies in classrooms around the country that came straight out of drug enforcement manuals from the war on drugs to have these kids quickly expelled or suspended. And there are now 17,000 police officers in public schools across the country. Data reveals that the cops outnumber counselors in 3 out of 5 and 4 out of the top 10 biggest school districts in the country, including New York City, Chicago, Miami-Dade County, and Houston. Right? So every problem in America, the only solution that those in power have is more cops. Right? Education isn't good, more cops. Poverty in our neighborhoods, more cops. And the result of that is astounding. I want to read what the school-to-prison pipeline looks like from a student. This is included in Teaching for Black Lives, the student Hanaya's story by Hanaya Muhammad. She wrote about being a student with an incarcerated parent. She said, right now my father is in jail and no one will tell me what's going on with his situation or when he might get out. I've overheard family members and friends say my father has 3 strikes. I don't know if that means he would get life or a long time locked up. It's sad to know those are his options. My father had trouble in school too, but he didn't have anyone to look out for him because both his parents used crack cocaine. He had problems at home, and at school, instead of supporting him, they labeled him and isolated him, saying he was a threat to other kids at only age 6 or 7 years old. I got arrested for the first time after my friends got in a fight with a woman on an AC transit bus. The police arrested me right from school 2 months after the incident, saying that they had me on video camera on the bus. They put me in an unmarked car alone with 3 big guys. I was scared, thinking they might hit me or rape me. They didn't have uniforms, so I wasn't even sure they were really police. The police told my mother I didn't do anything, but I was considered an accessory because I was with the girls who got in the fight. This is happening in school buildings across the country. And when you look at the children who are being killed by police across this country, when you hear the story of 7-year-old Ayanna Jones or 12-year-old Tamir Rice and the recent killing of 17-year-old Antoine Rose, maybe we have to go beyond the school-to-prison pipeline and start talking about the school-to-grave pipeline. So, in Cutting School, Professor Rooks makes a really important observation when she says, quote, "The most high-profile cases associated with the emergence and growth of the Black Lives Matter movement are synonymous with the cities, towns, and states that either have aggressively fought desegregating their traditional public schools or have downsized their traditional education systems and replaced them with a variety of alternative educational plans. This is slow murder by other means." And she goes on to say that Florida, where teenager Trayvon Martin was murdered by neighborhood watchman volunteer George Zimmerman, is the state with the largest number of virtual charter schools in the country. Ferguson, Missouri is where 18-year-old Mike Brown was shot by police officer Darren Wilson. At the time he was shot, his heavily poor and of color Normandy, Missouri school district had gone bankrupt and had lost its accreditation and was trying to arrange for suburban districts to educate their children. Ohio, where 12-year-old Tamir Rice was killed on a playground by a police officer while playing with a toy gun, leads the nation in the rate of expansion of charter schools. And she goes on to the high-profile cases, and I think there's a connection between the disregard of Black lives by police in the streets and the disregard of Black lives by corporate education reformers and school privatization in the underfunding of Black schools. So this is the context in which the rise of the Black Lives Matter at school movement really took off, and I want to tell that story and talk about what the resistance can be. And it started in Seattle at an elementary school, a great elementary school, John Muir Elementary. And at this school, they'd been doing professional development for several years around racial equity work, and the teachers decided at the beginning of the school year, not this year, but the last school year, that they wanted to hold an event to celebrate the Black lives of the kids at their school. So they partnered with a community organization called Black Men United to change the narrative, and the idea was that all the educators and families and community members would stand out front of the school and high-five the kids as they came in that day and hold a rally inside the school. And the great art teacher there created a t-shirt that said, "Black Lives Matter, We Stand Together." And the teachers are going to wear that shirt that day. Well, then the media found out and became a big news story. Then the right wing lost their minds. You had white supremacists sending threats to the school and hate mail, and then some particularly hateful person made a bomb threat of an elementary school for saying that, the audacity to say that the Black lives there were valued. So, to the great credit of the teachers at John Muir, they went through with the event even after the school district canceled it because of the threat. It was smaller than it would have been, but there was a lot of courage there to go through. And then my friend Wayne Au, whose son goes there, put me in touch with the art teacher there and a couple of the teachers there, and we said, "What can we do to support you? This is outrageous." And we came up with an idea of trying to get every school to wear the shirts to school that say Black Lives Matter, because they couldn't do a bomb threat against every school. So we put a resolution forward in our union, and we thought, well, it'll be a good fight, and we'll raise some consciousness in our union about this issue. And there was some incredible testimony by Black teachers who were just done with being treated as second-class citizens and seeing the school-to-prison pipeline And when the testimony was done, we had a unanimous vote in support. Yeah. And then I thought, okay, well, we had a unanimous vote of the union to support the Black Lives Matter at School Day of Action, but how many are really going to show up with the shirt on that day? Well, we began building support. We got the Seattle PTA to vote to support this day of action. We held a press conference with the NAACP and the PTA and the Social Equity Educators Group that I'm a part of in Seattle and a lot of others. And we began to get flooding of orders for these t-shirts. And on October 19th of that year, we were just astounded when some 3,000 teachers came to school that day in the Seattle Public Schools out of around 5,000 educators wearing Black Lives Matter shirts. And, you know, teachers taught lessons that day about institutional racism and other important issues around the Black Lives Matter movement, and it was truly exciting, but I had no idea where it would go, if it was a one-off action. And then we saw the teachers in Philadelphia on their own, without really coordinating, take it up and do a similar action. And then in Rochester that same year, they did a similar action. And then we knew there was really momentum to carry this thing forward. And we were able to go through the UCOR caucus, collection of social justice caucuses in the unions around the country, to propose the idea of making this a national initiative. And over the course of the fall, we had a whole bunch of planning calls, and we coordinated an entire Black Lives Matter at School week this year for the first week of February that was truly inspiring. We came up with three demands. We had, number one, end zero tolerance discipline and implement restorative justice. Number two, mandate Black history and ethnic studies in K-12 curriculum. And number three, hire more Black teachers. And I want to talk about a little about that last demand. A recent study shows that low-income Black boys who had at least one Black teacher in their third, fourth, or fifth grade had a 39% lower probability of dropping out of high school than their peers who had no Black teachers during that year. And since 2002, the total number of African American teachers has decreased by 26,000. Literally tens of thousands of Black teachers have been lost since 2002. Even as the overall teaching workforce has increased by 134,000. In 2015, the Albert Schenker Institute reported a similarly stunning decline in the number of Black teachers around the country. For example, in Philadelphia, the number of Black teachers declined by 18.5% between 2001 and 2012. In Chicago, in that same figure dropped nearly 40%. And in New Orleans, we had a 62% drop in Black teachers. Why? Right? Teach for America. Right? So remember that Arnie Duncan, Obama's Secretary of Education, called Hurricane Katrina the greatest thing to ever happen to the New Orleans public school system. Wiped out the schools so you could bring in charters. You could bring in privatized education. You could wipe out the union, which was many, many Black teachers who were unionized, and then bring in untrained, 5 weeks training teachers from Teach for America, predominantly white. So these were the demands that we coordinated to raise in this week of action. And then we had another strategy, which was we broke up the 13 principles of the Black Lives Matter organization into teaching points for the week. And so Monday was restorative justice, empathy, and loving engagement. So we taught lessons about that on Monday. On Tuesday, we taught about diversity and globalism and the African diaspora. On Wednesday, we taught trans-affirming, queer-affirming, and collective value. On Thursday, we taught about intergenerational black families and black villages. And on Friday, we taught about black women and unapologetically black. It was probably my favorite week of teaching. And these demands have had real impact. I'm teaching the first ethnic studies class in Seattle because of this Black Lives Matter at School movement. It was the initial demand our first year, and we formed a coalition with the NAACP, and students showed up and rallied and testified at school board meetings. And at the end of the school year, the school district finally relented, and now we have a task force that has been meeting all year that piloted the program in several classrooms across Seattle. And it's really been inspiring to see the concrete steps forward for public education that can be made when it's done in a grassroots organizing way, not from corporate billionaires who have no experience or really will to improve the public schools. And then just last week, we had another huge victory. We brought forward a resolution for next year's Black Lives Matter at School action to the National Education Association, the NEA. And I'm proud to say that my union voted overwhelmingly to support the Black Lives Matter at School week next year, so we finally have official sanction from our union. I hope you all will join me in that next year. I'm really excited to see where it goes. And I just want to move to talking about the history of black struggle for education and putting this Black Lives Matter at School movement in some context. I think we need to start by looking at the struggle for education under slavery, right? They called it stealing a meeting when slaves would sneak off and find places outside of the eyes of the overseers and the masters and teach each other to read and write, and saw literacy as a key component to their liberation, right? And the consequences for being a literate black person were severe, right? There's an important book called The Education of Black Folks, The Education of Blacks in the South from 1860 to 1935. And there's stories of slaves. Routinely, the punishment was having a finger chopped off if you were caught reading. In some instances, just killed. And this former slave, Louisa Gauss, writes about this struggle for education under slavery. She said, "No, child, white people never teach colored people nothing but to be good to their master. What learning we would get in those days has been we got at night. We taught ourselves." And then with the victory in the Civil War and the coming of Reconstruction, W.E.B. Du Bois said public education for all at the expense of the public was in the South a Negro idea. Right? So mass public schooling in the South was a product of former slaves demanding an education as a condition to their freedom, right? And again, James Anderson writes, in 1866, this is only a year after the Civil War ended, okay? In 1866, by 1866, there were at least 500 native schools already in operation throughout the South. Native schools were public schools that were created by ex-slaves. And this was even before the Freedmen's Bureau and the radical Reconstructionists came to actually support black education and public schooling across the South. Ex-slaves then helped to create mass public schooling systems across the South. And it's important to note that This fight by ex-slaves to implement public schools was of huge benefit to poor white people in the South, right? That had also not received education and would not have if it wasn't for the ex-slaves who led this fight. And it's incredible to see photographs from the years right after slavery ended of integrated classrooms of white and black students sitting next to each other, learning together, of black teachers in those classrooms, of white teachers in those classrooms, until radical Reconstruction was quickly halted, right? And the rise of Jim Crow segregation and the Ku Klux Klan brought an end to those integrated experiments. And the Jim Crow era of schooling is really amazing. Rooks writes that, quote, "The states that most aggressively lynched their black citizens were also those where education of blacks was most consistently contested following the Civil War." That really reminds me, right? In the states where there was the most lynching, you also had the least access to education for black people. Let's look at today. In the states where you have the cases of Mike Brown, right? Tamir Rice, all these examples are incredible levels of segregation, of privatization of our schools. In Alabama in 1877, the post-Reconstruction constitution of the state limited the funding stream for black schools to poll taxes, the amount black people paid for the privilege to vote. Then a few years later, they even took that money and gave it to white schools. Right? So Rooks writes, quote, "Legislatures across the South joined in to ensure that the expenses for the education of white children would be primarily borne by black communities. Even southern states such as Kentucky that instituted colorblind provisions for financing the education of all children, the state managed to get around legal obligations by simply not providing many schools for black children to attend. Laws mandating equal financing made little difference if there were simply no buildings." And actually, my grandparents were part of traveling across the South, starting schools across the South for black folks in this era. And then you also had an interesting development where white philanthropists decided that black people needed to be educated too. And wanted to join in this movement. But let's look at how maybe you could call it the first round of corporate education reform looked like. So there is a gathering of these white philanthropists. They actually met on a train to discuss how they were going to create more schools for black folks. And one of these people was George Winston, the president of North Carolina's College of Agriculture and Mechanic Arts. And he said at this large gathering of philanthropists supporting education for black people, he said, quote, "Black people in the South must be taught to work, to submit to authority, to respect their superiors. The entire system of public education for the Negro race from top to bottom should be industrial." Right? And there was no dissent from any of the philanthropists that were there. Right? That was basically the understanding, is we need schooling for black people because we need a way to discipline them, to train them to be obedient workers, and to give them the basic literacy skills that are needed to be implemented to keep corporate America humming along. And this is really where the debates between W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington emerge about what is the purpose and function and nature of public education. And I really want to highlight one era here, because then you have the Brown versus Board of Education decision that, right, calls for the ending of the, quote, separate but equal schooling, and is supposed to lead to the integration of schools. But there's incredible ways in which the South managed to get around any integrating of schools. And I think they hold important lessons for our movement today. Because Rooks writes in her book, quote, in the post-Brown v. Board of Education era, Southern states implemented so-called freedom of choice plans under which families and students could opt out to attend public schools of their choice. This created what became known as segregation academies, private white schools funded totally by private donations and tax dollars, some of which was actually paid by black families. You have black families paying money, tax dollars, and then that money is going to these segregation academies for white kids. And then the White Citizens Council of Mississippi opened the first chain of 13 segregation academy schools across the South, and they too were funded by taxpayer dollars. Do these sound familiar at all? The word school choice came from the White Citizens Councils in the South. That was the term school choice. And today, school choice is supposed to be the new civil rights movement? When you know the origins of these things, it's utterly absurd, right? And today, these school choice academies are mostly black and brown kids, but it's siphoning off public school dollars from taxpayers and put into private hands, and still creating segregated academies. So I just want to end by looking at what the struggle. I want to look a little bit at the Black Power struggles, and then our struggle today, and how we can begin to reverse some of these problems. Because I think oftentimes we look at the education during the Black Power era, we think about it as the urban rebellions of black youth and like the Black Panther Party and, you know, patrolling the police. And then we look at education struggles as the realm of white college students protesting against the Vietnam War. And it's often just separated, right? But I think we have to see that the mass urban rebellions that occurred sometimes in the form of burning down cities, sometimes in the form of policing the police, these led to a huge expansion of black people having access to education and higher education, and that those people who had been starting the riots and policing the police now were actually in colleges and universities with a whole set of demands that came out of that era. And many of them around ethnic studies programs, black history, Chicano history, Asian American history, right? All these different struggles actually had an educational dimension that was really important to those movements. And I think that's really the tradition and legacy that we stand in, this long history of the struggle for black education. I think that it was there's an important quote from a New York City activist that's detailed in a book called We Are an African People that I highly recommend everyone read about the history of civil rights and black power era struggle for black education. And there's a quote in it from an activist named Doxie Wilkerson about what this era of struggle meant. And he said, quote, it's not the education of black men and women that will achieve their liberation. It's the liberation of black Americans that will assure their effective education. But then he goes on to say, yet the overwhelming majority of African Americans polled in Ebony in 1970 cited improved education as a response to the question, how will blacks make real progress? So I think this is an important point, because I think so much hope is placed on education alone to solve all the problems of our society, Okay? And I think that education can be a really powerful battleground in the struggle for full equality for all people, right? But if you get straight A's in school and you can't afford to go to college, right? If you get straight A's, but then you're shot down in the streets by police, right? Then you really can see the limitations of education alone as a strategy. And we have to actually redefine education as well in this struggle, because high achievement in an educational system designed to reproduce capitalism, designed to reproduce inequality, high achievement in a system that's designed to reproduce institutional racism, right, won't actually take that system down. So I think that, in fact, the greatest teacher of all is struggle. And the greatest classroom is the movement itself. What did this country think about police and black people before the Black Lives Matter movement? Oh, we're colorblind society, right? That movement put that lie to rest, right? What did people think about women and their bodies and sexual assault before this Me Too movement, right? They were invisibilized. But the Me Too movement taught the whole country something. What did this nation think about the ruling class in this country before Occupy? It was invisible. There isn't a ruling class until there was a movement in every city that said, yes, there is a 1% that's hoarding all the wealth, right? And you can see how struggle after struggle has been the greatest teacher this country has ever had. And that's what we need to do. We need to build mass struggle to educate this country. And part of that struggle is a struggle inside the classroom to teach anti-racist, to teach ethnic studies, to teach about this vastly unequal society. But part of it has to be organizing our communities, organizing our unions. And I think the great power and potential of this Black Lives Matter at School movement is that it brings together so many important forces to create social change. It brings together educators, with our unions, with parents and students, with community, right? With social movements like the Black Lives Matter movement. And that's a vision for social movement unionism that combines the power of workers to withhold their labor that we saw in the great strikes across the red states this year. We saw that power. Imagine harnessing that power with the power of the social movements in the streets for Black Lives Matter. Imagine harnessing those movements and connecting it to the caging of immigrant children, right? And bringing those movements together. And I think then you'll begin to see a social force that's strong enough to challenge the wealthiest people on earth, like Bill Gates, like Eli Broad, like the Walmart family, who are using their fortune to continue Segronomics. And then I think we'll actually be able to build a force to remake our education system and actually remake our society to tear down the institutions of racism and build an education system that's about empowering kids to act collectively and collaborate and to unlock their imagination. And that's the type of world that I want to fight for, and I hope you'll join me in that struggle. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.